This episode is brought to you by Athletic Greens. I get asked all the time what I would take if I could only take one supplement. The answer is invariably Athletic Greens. I view it as all-in-one nutritional insurance. I recommended it, in fact, in the 4-Hour Body. This is more than 10 years ago, and I did not get paid to do so. With approximately 75 vitamins, minerals, and whole food sourced ingredients, you'd be very hard-pressed to find a more nutrient-dense and comprehensive formula on the market. It has multivitamins, multi-mineral greens complex, probiotics and prebiotics for gut health, an immunity formula, digestive enzymes, adaptogens, and much more. I usually take it once or twice a day just to make sure I've covered my bases if I missed anything I'm not aware of. Of course, I focus on nutrient-dense meals to begin with. That's the basis. But Athletic Greens makes it easy to get a lot of nutrition when whole foods aren't readily available. From travel packets, I always have them in my bag when I'm zipping around. Right now, Athletic Greens is giving my audience a special offer on top of their all-in-one formula, which is a free vitamin D supplement and 5 free travel packs with your first subscription purchase. Many of us are deficient in vitamin D. I've found that true for myself, which is usually produced in our bodies from sun exposure. So adding a vitamin D supplement to your daily routine is a great option for additional immune support. Support your immunity, gut health, and energy by visiting athleticgreens.com/TFS. You'll receive up to a year's supply of vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your subscription. Again, that's athleticgreens.com/TFS, as in Tim Ferriss Show. athleticgreens.com/TFS.
The Work Lab podcast from Microsoft answers the questions that keep business leaders up at night. Like, how can I reinvent processes for the AI era, from customer service to sales to HR? How can I prepare for AI to fundamentally transform jobs, companies, industries, and the whole economy? Don't panic, tune in. Each episode of Work Lab brings you the top experts, hard data, and actionable insights to help you future-proof your organization. Check out Work Lab, that's WORKLAB, no spaces, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hisashiburi janeka. This is Tim Ferriss. This is the Tim Ferriss Show. This episode is brought to you by HipDial. HipDial is how I do conference calls. Anytime you need more than 2 people on the phone, you give out a phone number, no PIN required, and you will get a text message when people join, so you don't have to sit around staring at the ceiling, watching paint dry or otherwise. It's great, so go to hipdial.com/Tim. That will get you a free month. You can play around with it. It is awesome. It is carefree. It removes some of the headache from your life. Give it a shot. This episode is with my friend Chase Jarvis. Chase is a professional photographer and the CEO of creativelive.com, which I'm also an advisor to. He is the youngest person to ever be named a Hasselblad Master, Nikon Master, and ASMP Master. Since opening his own studio, Chase has photographed for Volvo, Nike, Apple, Microsoft, REI, Honda, Subaru, Lady Gaga, Red Bull, the list goes on and on. He is very famous for a hyperkinetic style. He was one of the first people to use octocopters, and he emphasizes lifestyle, sports, and portraiture. Really made his name with a lot of very high-stakes skiing, alpine photography. Creative Live, his company, is an online learning platform that broadcasts live classes to an international audience. So they have more than 2 million students in 200 countries. If you can imagine sort of PBS on steroids, you have these live classes with masters of all sorts of disciplines, including photography, creativelive.com. You can check it out. I've done a class there as well. You can watch for free. It's high def. They have many different cameras, dollies, etc. And then if you want access to the classes later, you have to pay. That's how it works. That's the business model. You could call it a freemium pricing model. And it's pretty rad. So check it out. The company has headquarters in Seattle and San Francisco. I've been on there, like I mentioned. Pulitzer Prize winning photographers have been on there. Top entrepreneurs of all sorts, including people like Reid Hoffman from Greylock, who's considered the oracle of Silicon Valley. And that's it about Creative Live. But the story of Chase, the story of the development of his art, and not only that, but bridging the gap, crossing the chasm from artist to entrepreneur to very fast scaling a successful startup, is a fascinating one, and I hope you enjoy it.
Optimal minimal.
At this altitude, I can run flat out for a half mile before my hands start shaking.
Can I answer your personal question?
Now would have seemed an appropriate time.
What if I did the opposite?
I'm a cybernetic organism, living tissue over a metal endoskeleton.
The Tim Ferriss Show.
So, Mr. Jarvis.
Yes, sir.
The tables have been turned.
They have been. I'll cross my legs like you've crossed yours.
Yeah, I'm not sure what to do. This is a new scenario for you people who can't actually see what we're doing. This is an experiment with the Tim Ferriss podcast, also brought to you in moving pictures.
Yes.
And
normally you don't videotape it, right?
I normally, meaning the first two episodes, did not videotape it. And so I'm trying to sit somewhat like the host from Masterpiece Theater. I feel like that's appropriate, given the professional setting. Why don't you tell us where we are?
We are in a studio called Creative Live, mm-hmm. which is a startup based here in San Francisco and in Seattle. Mm-hmm. I'm the co-founder with my good friend Craig Swanson, who's not here. And it is an education platform that connects the world's top experts in creative fields with a global audience all over the world. That's what global means.
I was always wondering what that meant. So we first met how? I was trying to think of it today, and I couldn't piece it together.
I don't know.
Had to be a good number of years ago.
It was several.
But we've had a lot of adventures together.
We have
together.
Had some good adventures.
Spent sure. a lot of time OTK, lots of travel, always bumping to each other in airports.
Around the world.
But what I'd love you to perhaps do first is just give people the Chase overview. What's Chase? Who is Chase Jarvis? Just a little bit of background, because I can obviously pontificate, but I want to give people an intro.
I'll give you an opportunity to pontificate later. No, I was born, and I'm just kidding. I have spent my whole life as an artist. Mm-hmm. The career as a photographer is really the only mm-hmm. career I've ever had until co-founding Creative Live with Craig about three years and change, in a little grimy warehouse in South Seattle. We launched, I think it was in April, actually, and to rapid growth and success. And then about a year later, we nailed some venture funding, and we just closed our Series B, and now there's about 100 people that are employed here in Creative Live. And so there's this transition from myself as photographer, artist, traveling all over the world, shooting for the top brands, and there was this, I sort of scratched my own itch, because when I bailed on medical school and dropped out of a PhD in philosophy to pursue my dream of becoming a photographer, and there was nowhere to get any damn good education. There was no, I didn't want to go back to school, yeah. And then I didn't want to, you know, that it was a very closed world 10 years ago. There's not a lot of access to information. Mm-hmm. And I said, man, if I'm ever in a position to change this sucks. Yeah. I want to change it. And so by collaborating with my friend Craig, some 10 years later, we did exactly that. And so it's working.
Shazam. So I'm glad you started with the artist bit, because I want to delve into that. The first few guests we've had have ranged from sort of investors to chess competitors.
Oh, wow. People are going to be so disappointed with
so
this.
So I was hoping
podcast.
We could really lower their expectations by having you on this time.
Good. It was a homeless guy. He's not too.
No, but the fact that you went from being an artist and getting to that point, I want to delve into a little
sure.
bit, because obviously getting to the point where you're doing shoots with huge brands and flying octocopters before that was a thing, yeah. and so on and so forth, uh-huh. you don't just jump into that as your first gig, I have to
For
assume.
For sure.
But moving from that to really ending up in more of a management position, I want to talk about kind of how that's felt.
And did you just call me a manager?
You're a middle manager, really, is when it comes down to it. You've seen Dilbert, right?
Perfect, yes.
yeah. Oh, pointy-haired
Perfect.
Bosses.
Yeah. I had that little part in Office Space. That was me.
But given how professional I want to keep this, I also want you to start sort of gestating on a question,
sure.
which is related to a concept I'm going to borrow. It's from Aisha Tyler, and it's called self-inflicted wounds. So at the end of our talk, I want you to think of some ridiculous story, could be laughable, catastrophic, oftentimes it could be involving alcohol, something where you've just made a complete ass of yourself.
Oh,
and I know you have a pretty good selection to go through.
I just went, I got a whole memory bank full of that. My RAM is full.
So photography.
Yes.
How did you first get into photography, and how did you get to your first, what was your first paying gig?
My first paying gig was...
Well, let's backtrack.
So sure, how did you get into photography? There, I'm going to try and sort of relate the artist mentality to whatever audience is watching, because I feel like the artist mentality is actually, if we take one step back, it's a creative mentality, and I also believe that creativity is the new literacy. Yeah. So that creativity, like a lot of the investments you do, highly creative, yeah. your approach to them, what the founders are making of those companies. So whether yeah. you're taking pictures, building a business, managing a hedge fund, there's a ton of creativity involved. Yeah. And so art is sort of but a subset of creativity.
Yeah.
And I think that's a theme that's going to continue. I'm forecasting the future of our conversation today. That's a theme that I'm going to continue.
You're already time traveling.
Yes. I'm going to continue to bring us back to that, because yeah. I think that's a really important core. My personal experience growing up, I was a very creative kid. And yet being an artist as a kid was always like, oh, that kid's really creative. And yeah.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Seattle.
Okay.
And I'm an only child because I was a little bastard. I don't know if I can say bastard.
Scared him off?
I did.
Oh, come on.
I don't know if I can say bastard.
I'm coming from Long Island. Okay. I was hoping to drop F-bombs when I'm seeing so
it's all yours,
self-conscious
man.
Here with all these professional cameras.
But my childhood was a very creative childhood. My parents gave me a block of wood. I'd go play in the backyard for hours. I sat at the adult table because there was no kids' table.
And the solo kid table. Go sit in the corner.
Basically.
What did your parents do?
My dad was a cop, and my mom was an executive assistant at a big biotech company they did Cialis.
Oh.
Yeah, they founded Cialis, and that was sold.
So much.
Yeah, so she did okay on that one. So I came from a very middle class background, and there was a good work ethic, but the whole creative artist thing, I felt very creative, but I was also sort of in a jock's body, so I was good at sports, and I could never reconcile those two things.
What'd
as
you
a
play?
Kid. Soccer and football.
Mm. Which were you better at?
I had opportunities to play either in college.
Bo Jackson and both.
I ended up playing soccer at San Diego State, which is a top 10 D1 school. Yeah. So it was a good way to go to college. But I had a hard time reconciling the artist and artist and jock. They didn't go together, at least in my high school. You had to sort of be one or the other. And I sort of took the jock path because it could lead to school. And at least at that time, it was safer.
Yeah, sure.
And it was really in that sort of the punk skate surf punk scene in Southern California where I moved to go to college that I sort of was able to understand that those two things could coexist.
Yeah.
And actually that was a powerful combination.
That's interesting. I never really thought of that. I mean, the surf culture is so pervasive there.
Yeah. And surf, skate, and it was sort of a DIY ethic, hacker mentality. I think that's part of that was something that I definitely took away from Southern California after going to school down there. And photography was something that I had grown up being on the other side of the camera. At my college, I was the guy who would get interviewed after the soccer games on television and whatnot because I was reasonably well associated with cameras.
You were going to say handsome, weren't you?
I'm dashing. Dashing. If you could only smell.
I smell really good.
I just got off an airplane. I smell terrible.
Smell
terrible. But photography was a really low barrier way, and I had grown up around pictures, and I remember a particular picture, a muddy soccer game that made me realize, oh my God, that's like a moment. It's never going to go away. And now that I have it sort of locked in a picture, maybe I can do that over and over again. But then that reality voice kicked in, this sort of like that voice. Part of the reason that Creative Live exists is because we have this, culturally there's this bias against, oh, I don't want my kid to grow up be an artist because he's going to be homeless or a drug addict or he's going to play music.
Well,
and
starving
tell
artist. Yeah, I mean, starving that, those two go together.
They do. They do. Like.
And I'm not saying in reality, but in mass perception.
Yeah, in culturally. So I, again, sort of recoiled from that thought.
So your first active photography was then in college?
Immediately after college. My grandfather died on my college, like 2 days before my college graduation, which was terrible thing. Dropped dead of a heart attack. The silver lining in that was I got his cameras. I was gifted his cameras. And it sort of was this a permission to go explore the world. So I threw him in a backpack and walked the earth for 7 months with my then girlfriend, now wife, Kate, who you know.
After graduating.
Yeah, and we just my grandfather passed away. I got his cameras. He said, look, let's just go explore the world. And I want to learn to take pictures because I want to get in touch with this side that I've sort of been repressing.
Yeah.
And taught myself how to use a camera and came back, was a ski bum in Steamboat, Colorado. Started taking pictures there. It was where I first sold pictures. And basically
in Colorado?
Started, taking pictures of what I was passionate about, which is hiking, climbing, fly fishing, basically extreme sports, skate, surf, that whole world that I'd grown up in. And I was very passionate about it, so it was easy to make connections in that community. And I had good pictures of fancy people that started being sold for lots of money.
So wait, what? Hold on. So I mean, I find it, this is part of the fun for me, and the reason I wanted to start the podcast is because we've spent years hanging out, but normally I don't know this stuff, right. And I want to dig into it because it's fun, but stuff. If I sit down, I'm like, let me ask you 70 questions for 2 hours, it's just weird, and it's like a CIA interrogation, but this is a good pretext.
There was that one time,
sorry, about the sodium pentothal, but the first, do you remember the first sale? Except for instance,
I do.
I remember when I had my first sort of real business anything in college, teaching this accelerated learning seminar. And I felt like richer than I'd ever felt in my life because I was making $8 an hour in the college library, guest library. So tell me about like your first sale or few sales. How did those come about?
The first sale came about because I grew up skiing and snowboarding, was very familiar with the subject. I got into some, with the good crowd, had photographs of people on next year's equipment because I knew the people, the manufacturers and the reps and all that stuff. And if you have the right pictures of the right people and the right equipment, then the manufacturers come knocking for next year's stuff. So a manufacturer saw my work, got in touch and said, hey, we like this picture, and this picture. I ended up licensing, not selling outright, but licensing an image for $500 and a pair of skis.
Nice.
That was my first.
That's a big first sale.
And when I would think I was probably literally making $10 an hour at that time. And you're like, wait a minute, I just sold that for $500 after, you know, from going skiing for a couple of days with my buddies. I'd like to replicate that. So what did I do? What worked? What didn't? And then I set on a Tim Ferriss learning experiment on how can I replicate this? Yeah. And just started doing that over and over and up the ante every time.
What were you doing for $10 an hour?
I was tuning skis at the local ski stop right at the base of the mountain in Steamboat, Colorado. When Kate and I got back from Europe, we were totally broke. So we threw everything in a car, drove to Colorado and got... We were just deferring education and life a little bit and ended up having the time of our lives. Ironically, you know very, very well, better than most about adventure and how that propels one's life. So,
you have some. I mean, if people want to get a taste of, what are your favorite videos? Obviously, the stuff with the octocopter did really well, which you can look at. You can look for on YouTube or anywhere else. But if people want to get a taste of I got an international man of mystery who is Chase Jarvis.
I have a pretty good YouTube channel. It's just YouTube/Chase Jarvis. And I think there's a couple hundred videos and several of them with more than a million views. But mostly they're adventures all over the world on pretty much every continent except for Antarctica. A lot of...
You gotta do something with your life, man.
Exotic
what are you gonna
locations?
Make Antarctica happen?
Oh, I know. My dad, he just stuck a stake in the ground and said, I'm gonna beat you to Antarctica. So I gotta find a way to get there in the next 12 months. There's a lot of adventure, and you can go to my YouTube channel or my website and see it.
So, I mean, I think that a lot of people listening or watching probably hear this and they go, oh my God, like that's a dream scenario. I got to travel the world, probably had brands or clients pay for most or all of it.
And you get paid very well on top of it.
And you get paid very well on top of that. So how did
helicopters and yachts, it's really ridiculous, but it didn't start that way, I promise.
So, well, of course not. So a lot of people sort of enter the creative funnel, right? Mm-hmm. I would like to try to be a photographer, or I want to be a photographer, or fill in the blank, right?
Sure.
Painter, dancer,
writer,
whatever. Writer, and then you have all these different...
You're blocking my shot there with your hand.
I'm doing that on purpose because I don't want the awesomeness of your face to overwhelm people. And I know what I'm doing.
I know, you're a professional. It's like...
See if I can get my big Danish head right in the way. So, where was I? I was going to...
You're saying that
ask
a lot
a
of
question
people
answer
top of
myself.
The
fun. Oh, yes. So, how did you end up... What do you think... What were the milestones or like inflection points or chance encounters that led you to the point where you're flying around in helicopters with top athletes, paid by the top brands? Like, I mean, because I can point to a handful of things, right? With the 4-hour work week, like 2007 South by Southwest was
one of the
tipping
bloggers
points.
Bloggers Lounge, you told me about that.
Right. Like
Robert Scoble.
Exactly. Like I can identify these points. So what were some of those points for you?
A couple of the key ones, actually taking the camera that my grandfather passed to me when he died and actually teaching myself the art in a very unencumbered sort of way, where there was a lot of freedom, freedom to make mistakes, freedom to learn, and a reliance on yourself. So to me, that's a great way to learn, and to learn from others in a not dissimilar to Creative Live, how the world's best. Like, I would meet up with people all over the world and just connect with them around photography. So the learning phase, there was a lot of opportunity for exploration and making mistakes, and there wasn't a lot of stakes early on. But as soon as I decided that I wanted to do that, I threw myself into a lot of stakes. Like, trying, I know I want to do this professionally. How can I do it? Move to Steamboat, meet the right people, and then there is instantly stakes. I know that's a big thing for you with increasing the stakes, so it can accelerate learning. So the camera and having a little freedom to explore and play, basically, like get familiar in a way where there's not pressure. Then I put myself in a little bit of a pressure cooker by saying, and I didn't really declare it. Yeah. I said, like, I declared it to myself, but not overtly. I said, I'm going to try and do this. Being in a community, like putting yourself at the heart of where that stuff is happening.
Right.
If you want to do a startup, it's much easier in Silicon Valley than it is in Detroit, for example. So I did the equivalent of move to that. I wanted to shoot skiing and snowboarding, so I went to a hardcore ski town.
Yeah.
That was a big catapult. And then another inflection point was when I was setting my prices, not necessarily for the very first sale or the second sale, but when I realized that, wait a minute, once you are great at your craft, everything else is vision and the ability to execute. So let's put execute and craft in the same bucket, and then everything else is vision. And I think whether we're talking about how to hack the system from inside a big company or whether how to hack the system from an entrepreneurial standpoint or an artist standpoint, the way that I hacked the system was my first hired like day rate or gig was at several thousand dollars a day. So I sort of, I pushed myself to a level that was incredibly uncomfortable and required myself to deliver at the highest level.
Right.
But, and I charged accordingly because I'd done the work, done the research, and knew what the top guys and gals were getting.
Yeah.
And I put myself in that caliber right away.
Did they accept it off the bat, or do you have to negotiate for it? I mean, did you have some guy who's like, wait a second, kid. Like, I know that so-and-so, the Michael Jordan of, you know, ski photography is charging X, but all due respect, like, this is your first big gig or second big gig. I mean, how did you, or did you just ask and you were surprised they said yes?
I had a body of work that I hadn't actually done a lot with commercially.
Yeah.
So I felt like the quality, and I was doing, I was comparing my work to the work that I saw in the marketplace, honestly, and I was getting like peer reviews and whatnot. Yeah. And I knew that I had talent, but it really came to the boldness of where do I want to put myself in the marketplace? I'd rather have my first sale be here and not have anything down there. Because if you're the $400 dude,
then you have to claw your way up
and
to anything.
And that whole idea that when we get some more budget, we'll call you if you just do it for $400. No, they don't call the $400 dude. They call the $4,000 dude when they have a $4,000 budget. So the first, and I had to, I wasn't bluffing. I knew that I could do the work, but I said, you know, I think it was $2,500 a day, $2,500 a day. And they said, okay, well, it's a 6-day shoot. So like in my head, I'm shitting myself and doing the math. And it's more than I made last year. And I'm going to make it last, you know, next week. And they said, okay, that sounds fine. We might need to add an extra day.
You're like, and let me check my schedule.
Yeah. And literally, like, so there's like, I'm going to, like, okay, I'll get back to you on that. I'm going to go, you know, throw up in the bathroom. But again, there were some stakes there. There was, I knew that I could do the job.
Yeah.
But I also, I feel like I had an understanding of the marketplace and where, it was an indicator of where I wanted to go as well. I knew I wanted to be at a top price point and I wanted to do less work, but do high-end stuff. And again, I don't want to pretend that I didn't do a shitload. This is like a 10-year overnight success program here. Like, I was working in the trenches day in and day out, everything. I was eating, breathing, sleeping photography. But when I was able to start to sort of monetize my craft, I did so at a very high price point. And little note, if someone ever says yes that quickly, you didn't ask for enough.
Of course.
So what happens?
That's why the good negotiators, even if they want to say yes quickly, they'll push a little bit so that you feel better about the deal when it's done.
And that's exactly, I did some iteration of that, and I took a day to get back to him. And I knew that because she said yes so quickly, that the next time, if I was dealing with someone who was at a commensurate level of experience across the table from me, that and if I could do a great job on this job, that I could ask for more.
You talking about your wife or photography?
You just leave Kate out of this. She will flip you like a cheese omelet. I know you've been lifting. I know. You've been working on the biceps. There, Tim Ferriss experiments got you.
Two ostriches a day. That's my quota, at least. You know I love Kate. That's
I do. Oh yeah, she's. I just spoke with
amazing woman. You're a very lucky guy.
I think that there's a way to extrapolate that to every profession.
Yeah.
Like, how you're negotiating, and we've talked to Ramit about this a lot. Yeah. Ramit is like he's the man for negotiating, right? And he actually came on my podcast, Chase Jarvis Live, and talked a lot about this, but that's sort of prizing yourself.
Yeah.
And that is a learned thing.
It's totally learned. That's the thing. I think it's such a huge misconception because I always see so much resistance to negotiating. It's like, no. You memorize a couple of lines, try them out, and you're going to want to puke in the bathroom, like you said, and then you get through it, and you're like, okay, I'm kind of smelly now, but that was pretty awesome. Didn't get an extra 50%, got an extra 20%, and it's just role-playing and rehearsal.
It is.
And
it is practicing and showing up and letting the, be sweaty, but putting yourself, and I think I don't have to tell you or your listeners that they are familiar with your work. Like, put yourself in some low or not too serious stakes and negotiate against.
Go to the state fair or something.
Sure.
Go to the Alameda fair that they have every whatever, a couple of weeks, and negotiate for stuff that you don't actually really want all hell of a lot. And, like, don't be a jerk about it, but it's like, buy some low stakes stuff.
It also helps with, I think, some confidence. You repeat that thing, you get a little more confidence. And it, in a weird way, it also helped me understand the seriousness of the work, not in that the photography of skiers and snowboarders or skateboarders or surfers was serious, but in that the people that are on the other end of this transaction, they are betting their ass on me.
Oh,
if that doesn't turn out, they are fired.
They're done.
Yeah, because, and it started off small, but then as the budgets got to be, 50,000, 100,000, half million, some big productions, the people that are betting on
it. If it goes sideways, they're done.
Yeah. And you don't in photo and video, you don't really get too many, you can't be a dick because word gets around pretty quickly that you're not pleasant to work with, and you can't blow it because people are making big bets.
Well, I would imagine at that level, too, they're probably only a half a dozen to a dozen people they're considering.
Yeah,
I mean, it's a small community.
Oh, yeah, super, super tight.
So what are the most consistent mistakes that you see? We can stick with, I think, because you know the photography community so well, and you've interacted with so many photographers. This can, I'm sure, be extrapolated to creatives in general, which is pretty much everyone.
Right, and that's
unless
the point that I was
cyborg,
trying to make.
Unless you're like Bishop from Aliens. You have to be creative in some fashion.
Yes.
What are the most common mistakes that you see? Or just like the repetitive problems that you see?
So there's a handful, and I think it does apply, like you just prefaced, across every discipline. The being great at your craft is a requirement.
Yeah, yeah.
And I wouldn't suggest that you stop, that you don't try and get work or hustle or do all those other things while you're coming up, because that's a part of the game. And that's, Gary Vee is a big advocate for hustling. And so you got to hustle your whole way, but being great at your craft actually matters.
Yeah, yeah.
And having like the camera is like an extension of my arm. And you think about it, I've used the pro golf analogy. I don't know why I'm not crazy about golf, but those guys have to, and women, have to stand up on the tee and hit the ball down the middle because that's what they're paid to do. It doesn't matter if it's raining, sunny, windy, if there's 10 people watching or 10 million, they're paid to hit the ball down the middle. And as an artist, you're paid to make. And as an entrepreneur, you're paid to deliver the ROI to the shareholders. And as a wrestler, you're paid to win. Or like whatever your thing is, you have to be great at your craft in order to, I think, achieve. So there's this 10,000 hours, hardcore. The folks that I think are great, whether they're hacking the system and doing it in 10 hours or 10,000, that is, I think people want to skip that step.
Yeah, I get, for every email that I get about the craft of writing, I get 1,000 about how to market books. And I'm just like, hold on, the ratio is all wrong.
Yep.
So I would agree with that.
And so that gets overlooked. Like, I just want to be this awesome fashion photographer and hang out with like awesome, beautiful people in crazy locations. And it's like, dude, you got to be, like, actually pick up a camera and get good at that shit first.
Yeah.
And then you might be able to do, part.
All the glamorous.
Yeah, the second part. So I think that's a common mistake. The second one is that I think there's a belief that people who are successful, either they can sell themselves really well and they're natural at it.
Like, yeah.
I was a natural hard worker,
yeah.
But not a gifted like positioner and seller. And that was all learned in the same way that some of the stuff we talked about earlier was learned, the art of negotiation, the art of positioning yourself in the marketplace, of telling your story. That is not, at least it wasn't innate for me.
Yeah.
And I had to learn that. So there's another belief that, oh, if you have talent, then you just are successful, which is a total crock of horseshit. It's total bullshit. Ryan Holiday talks a lot about this. You have to like...
What is that? I mean, it's someone else's quote, but it's like there's nothing more common than, what is it, the unsuccessful man with talent or something like that.
Yeah,
it's just
they're tired for sure because there's so many of them. That idea of once you make something that if it's great, it will just be discovered is totally fiction.
Yeah.
The people that I know that are successful, as soon as it's done, the making part, then it's about packaging. And frankly, the narrative, like being a good storyteller, is mission critical to having your idea, project, plan, work, vision, company, whatever, spread.
Yeah.
So being able to tell a good story is another thing that people overlook. So being great at your craft, actually working hard to sell and position, the art of storytelling as a mechanism to get your stuff out there, those are huge things, both of which either people want to skip or people think that I don't have that gift, therefore I can't do it.
Right.
Or that guy's a jackass because he's not a real talent, he's actually just as great at selling himself.
Yeah.
But what actually matters is that person over there is doing the shit that you're not doing.
Yeah.
You know, they are.
They're
a New York Times bestselling author. So Tim got up, sat down at his computer, wrote every day until he had an 8,000-page book, and then narrowed it down to 400 pages, and then sold a million copies.
Like they stop that 8,000-page stuff. Oh my god!
I think
killer.
You had a backpack full of like. I was like, are those actual pages that are in there?
Oh my god! So on those two points then, what aside from obviously this tool that you've helped create, which is Creative Live, and you guys just particularly in photography and a lot of those areas, you just
photo design
just dominate.
Yeah, I mean, killing it in audio right now.
And it's
too.
Been fun to watch, you know, as obviously an advisor and investor with the company, just from the nascent stages to see this thing explode. It's been really fun. But aside from that tool, obviously, which exists now, what books, resources helped you become better at photography?
Sure.
And then also helped you get better at positioning, storytelling?
Sure. Wow.
Don't have to be books, but just like tools that people might be able to use.
Yeah, tools, a little bit of, this is going to be a date myself idea here, but when
this is already a date.
Going, I know, it's a mandate. It's a 2-hour mandate. Mandate not as in a thing that you have to do, but as in two men getting together. At first, it was the library. Literally, it was books like How to Negotiate Photography. When even the idea of licensing an image so you maintain the intellectual property instead of selling it. So there was some early stuff way back in the 90s.
Yeah.
As soon as I realized that I was good at the craft and that was developed primarily through repetition and feedback loops that I cultivated and created on my own, it was learning about sort of the business side of it. And I think there's a weird, you have to know your industry for sure. That's very, very beneficial. But all the big hacks, the leaps, the sort of the leapfrog things that I did in my career came from outside my industry. So instead of learning from other photographers, well, I have a huge respect for the masters that have, you know, paved the way before me, but I took a lot of cues from Andy Warhol and Jean-Michel Basquiat and Robert Rauschenberg, the artists in New York in the 50s, 60s, 70s, because they were sort of, again, they were hackers. They were finding out how to hack the system, and they were making art about making art, and they were, you know, they were sort of reinventing the game while they were playing it.
Right.
And I was always motivated to try and apply that to my work, and not so literally. Instead of taking in the way of taking a picture of a picture, like that would be too literal. The meta thing was fine, but I'm talking about how do you differentiate yourself in the marketplace?
Yeah.
If I look across and everyone else is doing this, yeah. how do you zig when everyone else is zagging?
Right. As opposed to trying to get better at zigging.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Be different, not better.
Right.
I mean, again, we've already agreed that the work has to be good. You have to be a good writer before you sell a million books. That's just fact.
Yeah.
At least a decent writer.
Yeah.
And so the same is true in the way that I approached it. And I learned that basically from those artists in the 50s, 60s, 70s in New York. So I've read a lot of artist biographies of people who have actually led amazing lives, done amazing things. And
what were the names again?
Jean-Michel Basquiat, he took sort of graffiti off the street and brought it into the gallery. Robert Rauschenberg, you know, large-scale guy, crazy mixed media. They were just people that were hacking the art scene in that era in New York. And they applied non-traditional techniques to getting noticed, to making art. They were zigging when everyone else is zagging, basically. The way that I zigged when everyone else was zagging in photography was I chronicled my exploits of learning my craft. And
smart.
It was 10 years before it was cool to be transparent, and I was actually sort of vilified for sharing trade secrets. So I would go out and try something, and it was before YouTube.
Traitor to the guild.
Yeah, literally. And I was like, well, I sort of saw the future that information was going to be free and you couldn't keep secrets, and the art industry in general, photography specific, was very closed.
Yeah.
So the way I approached it was like, well, here's how I'm going to be different. I'm going to share everything.
Yeah.
And in doing so, made a couple of haters, but slowly there was a rather large audience that would show up to not literally the shoots, but to the behind the scenes. There's no such thing as behind the scenes videos. Like before YouTube, it was Google Video.
Yeah.
And Yahoo Video, or just these terrible, terrible things. But I had no idea what I was doing. Yeah. I just knew that if more people were looking at my work, and if I could come across as someone that did good work and had a sort of a passion for life and what it is they're doing, that's a contagious sort of infectious thing. And that was generally the life that I was living. So I figured, I'll just point a camera at me.
Yeah.
And ultimately that was responsible for sort of a increased trajectory in my career, because then you're like, have you heard this guy who's sharing all, you know, and fancy Nike shoots and stupid little local shoots, the full gamut. And in doing so, you've already referenced a couple of videos on my YouTube channel. In doing so, created a large following, and it was in large part that following which helped unlock so many other things for me.
Yeah.
Because as you know, we've seen even the last, let's call it 5 years, people are now, like, as artists, we no longer require permission. We no longer require permission from anyone to share our work at scale.
Yeah.
You know, we don't have to, there's no more gatekeepers, the gallerist and the magazine and the, you know, my personal social following and the blog that I write at Chase Jarvis is larger than a lot of the media companies' outlets that hire me.
Right.
And so when that sort of transformed, that became an added value and a key differentiator. So again, what started off by sharing my experiences ultimately hacked the system, and that hacking the system gave me a lot of opportunity. Now, to go back to your question, like what books, what tools, I was literally just sort of analyzing pop culture.
Yeah.
The business books, like For Our Work Week was really inspirational. It was a long time ago, because you're about 110 years old now, right? It was one of your first.
Yeah, I've been taking all the 275 pills a day. Keeps my skin very supple.
Yes, you look great. But again, taking inspiration and ideas from other genres. So instead of reading like how to be a better photographer, it was like, you know, digital new media books. It was business books from guys like Guy Kawasaki and Tim Ferriss and like literally hacker books and avant-garde artist books that talked about not getting attention for the sake of attention, but how to create transformative art.
Yeah.
What do you do? Like, where do you go? What do you think about? What kind of permissions do you give yourself? So,
yeah, I think that looking outside of the usual suspects and one's own industry is so undervalued, and it's
massive.
So easy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's incredible how many things I've been able to personally pull from, say, I read sort of a biography or business history of Absolut, like the brand, everything. And I also read about Sky, and I don't really drink either, but I was so fascinated by how in a crowded market,
yep.
these two mega successes had been produced. Similarly, you know, a single SKU company is really fascinating. Like, they're more than one now, but like Red Bull, how do you license something from a company in Thailand and turn it into a multi-billion dollar company that now is becoming a media production behemoth?
So as an example, I was the first photographer within the USA to license images to Red Bull.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
That's cool.
There was a couple Austrians that had very thick accents.
How far back was this?
This was 90s.
Yeah. It's not that long ago, I mean, all things considered.
To have a multi-billion dollar brand now. Yeah. But it was the 90s, and it was at Squaw Valley, and there was a guy who had this Red Bull outfit, Red Bull jersey, and I happened to have great photographs of him. It was like a qualifier for one of the early X Games. And these guys approached me and said, we see you taking pictures of this guy. He's my God. And, you know, he ended up being...
That was
like
pretty
Arnold.
Good. That was very Arnie. Yeah.
California.
Yeah.
He literally gave me his card, and I had great pictures, and so they started licensing stuff. And I was like, there's this brand. It wasn't available anywhere in the U.S.
Yeah.
And so lo and behold, I ended up doing a lot of work for those guys through their cultural stuff with hip hop, and you know, shot large swaths of the top, you know, breakdancers in the world for them. Some of the best graffiti artists.
I didn't know that.
Yeah,
I became obsessed with their BC1 breakdancing competition back in the day.
Lords of the Floor was
insane.
The first one they did, and that was a gathering of a group of breakdancers that'll never be, you know, weren't ever together before then, and will never be together since. And I've got some pretty amazing photographs. So, but that's an example of. No one was actually interested in licensing images to a company that no one had ever heard of.
Yeah.
But going outside your industry, I'm not just looking for Outside Magazine and REI. I'm looking like, wow, here's this like Austrian beverage company that has this crazy history. And then I start to see it in the US. And so grabbing sort of those coattails and grabbing at threads that no one else was sensing, that was... It was helpful.
There were two books that
I found. We just leaned together and did that at the same time? Should we do it
I did.
Time?
I thought we were going to, like, Lady and the Tramp for a moment. That was very romantic. I got a little palpitation, but neither of us have shaved. It's
never.
Too much. So the two books that really helped me, or continue to help me to think of being different, good and different, right?
Sure, yeah.
It's necessary but not sufficient.
Yes.
There are two that are on the older side and one that's relatively new. The 22 Immutable Laws of Marketing.
Yep.
Really short read.
Super short. That book's like
super
that big,
short,
right?
And just gives fantastic examples of how, say, like Amstel Light becomes the only light imported beer. Boom. Like defines a category, owns it.
Yep.
Right? And the second, Blue Ocean Strategy.
Oh, yeah.
Really interesting
fantastic.
Book. And then the third, which is a little tech centric, but I think there's still a lot to be gained from it, is Business Model Generation.
Don't know that one.
It's a compilation of different business and revenue models.
Just
like,
a list.
Just like 100 different profiles of companies with different models.
Wow.
Whether it's distribution, manufacturing, customer segmentation, and there are two or three pages in that book that are checklists that allow you to go through and identify opportunities that you might not have seen or even thought of up to that point. Because it's like you can take the same product and sell it higher market, right? You can take the same product, sell it lower market. You can take the same product and distribute it differently, right? Going direct versus through retail versus distributors, whatever. And those three I've found really, really helpful for brainstorming. What are the...
Oh, gosh. So I want to talk more about books. I haven't really dropped any any real books.
I know. I'm bleeding a stone here.
I know. I'm having this weird... let's talk a little bit more current rather than sort of like way historical.
Yeah.
Like what 22 Immutable Laws of Marketing is like a classic.
Yeah.
That's way back. I feel heavily influenced by... And we have a similar circle of friends. Mm-hmm. Books that you have written, books that Gary Vee has written, Ryan Holiday with Trust Me, I'm Lying, How to Understand the Media.
Yeah.
You know, Gary has been pounding his chest for a long time about all the stuff that he pounds his chest on besides the Jets. But again, I look at those things.
For those of you who don't know Gary Vee, that's Vaynerchuk.
Vaynerchuk.
Yes. Vaynerchuk.
His most recent book, Jab, 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 Right Hook. guys like Austin Kleon wrote books called Steal Like an Artist. His most recent one that just came out, Share Your Work. All that.
I haven't seen that one. Steal Like an Artist is a fast read, good book.
Super small, fast read, And it's the premise on that book is basically, if you steal from one person, that's stealing. If you take, I took your idea, the 4-hour bike ride, right, or whatever, it's not really that original. But
get in line. Yeah. It's 100 Facebook ads.
I know. I've seen your face.
The
next
day
to
of reckoning
Facebook
is coming, I assure you.
But, like, drawing something from all of the people who you respect, yeah, and appreciate and admire, that's called research.
Yeah.
And Picasso's, you know, good artists borrow, great artists steal. There's a million quotes out there. And that's, it's just a book about inspiration. It gives you some courage to sort of hack the system to remix and reuse. And everything that's out there has been done. And it's just, how can we sort of undone or redo what's already out there, chunk it up into new pieces. So those are some more contemporary ones that, mm-hmm, again, very much outside photography. I feel like I've nailed my craft, and reading books in photography, I do that for pleasure. I respect and admire Leibovitz and Mapplethorpe and there's a dozen greats, but my inspiration comes from outside. So a lot of artist biographies and whatnot too. So how about Charlie's new book? Can we talk about that for a second? Or I just hijacked that. You go back
to
your thing.
We can. We'll come back to it.
Okay.
I'm curious to know what was your favorite day last week and why?
My favorite day last week, I was in Miami photographing Serena Williams for the upcoming Wilson campaign. I got to shoot Serena, Roger Federer.
That's cool.
Mika Azarenka. So
Serena could kick my ass, right? I mean, she looks like she could totally decapitate me.
You're just like, you're done.
No chance,
Done. You know, I don't have a bad thing to say about any of those. There's like 5 or 10 of the people that I shot of the top 20 tennis players, not just now, but ever in the history of tennis.
Yeah.
Federer, just like legendary. The guy speaks 5 languages, just like looks like a GQ model.
He's like never, Thomas Crown, but never good
been,
at tennis.
Yeah, never been injured, never opted out of a match before due to injury. And he has 300 matches more than anyone. Like these super athletes, basically. And just get to spend legitimate real time with these people on the court and make great pictures of them that they've never had made before. So that was a great day last week.
That sounds like a good day.
It's a good day. So, but I will say that I'm like, to change it to creative life for a second, I am more enamored and more fired up on the power of creativity to change the world. Yeah. More than ever before, I'm spending a huge and complete inordinate amount of time learning from the people that are in the startup world. I've learned a lot from you. I'm doing some angel investing, but focused very, very specifically on the creative space. And it's a really interesting. Do you know Mark Echo? Echo Clothing. Mark's a friend.
He did a guest post on my blog.
Oh,
also,
that's right. When he launched his book, right?
Yeah, he's a good guy.
What Mark thinks about startups is something that I just hopped on his coattails. That these companies aren't called founders, but the companies aren't found.
Yeah.
They're made. They're created.
Right.
You know, and so this idea of creatives and artists discovering or unlocking or creating the next sort of product, whatever it is, whether it's the next Facebook, Instagram, we could list any number of companies. Like that, to me, this vision of creator, artist, making things and these things being businesses, nonprofits, that's a beautiful picture of the future, I think. And that's one of the reasons I'm out there advocating for creativity. So my shoot with Serena and Roger Federer and Azarenka is actually very related to having an authentic understanding of what it takes to make and be and do, build businesses and shoot ad campaigns. They're not all that dissimilar.
No, I don't. I don't think they are at all. And I think it's really exciting to see the return of the polymath.
Mm-hmm.
So you used to, you know, back in the day, you had people like Benjamin Franklin or fill in the blank, who would be like amateur scientists and politicians and printers, and they would have these 5 or 6 different buckets of activities, and they could become world class at each of them.
Yep.
And then we moved into this period, which was pretty extended, of the hyper specialist, right? And it's like, all right, no, you're not going to make the radio. You're going to screw this one screw.
That's the factory mentality, which is sadly the same mechanism that our education system is based on.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which, what is a factory good at? It's making a bunch of things that are the same.
Yeah. Right? Exactly.
You're good at one thing. You're good at screwing the screw in, and that's what you do. And out pops the radio at the end. And it started with a bunch of raw material, and then you got the radio. But schools shouldn't be like that because people aren't like that. And the goal is not to turn out a bunch of people that people don't learn at the same rate, the same stuff. That's up. Soapbox.
No, it's true. And it's like, so
it's a bullshit system, to be honest.
And then you have, well, it's also just a societal norm, right? And I think they're intertwined. So you have. Let's say, I think it's Isaac Asimov, the science fiction writer, said specialization is for insects. And like any man should be able to like captain a ship and gut a pig and like, there's a long list. It's pretty awesome. But it's great to see with Kickstarter and Indiegogo and YouTube and blogs, much of which is free, right? You can certainly use WordPress.
Right. I do. Thank you, Matt.
And I do too. Thank you, Automatic. Yeah, thanks over there. And it's incredible how it is now permissible to become the equivalent of what Ben Franklin was.
I was told my whole career you have to specialize. And I specialized in pursuing the things that are interesting. I talked a lot about action sports, but then, you know, I also talked about fashion and I talked about breakdancing and I talked about all kinds of different cultural stuff. I've made TV shows, shot commercials, done ad campaigns, created startups, did the first iPhone app that shared images to social networks. And these are, I historically would have been called a dilettante.
Yeah.
But to be able to touch all these things and find out that they ultimately inform one another and they made at least my contribution to Creative Live, like, possible.
Yeah. Well, I think the disconnect, it seems, is that back in the day, let's just call it...
The 80s.
Back in the 80s... Back when we all had mullets and were happy about it. I was more of a rat tail man myself, but I was handsome. It was a dashing look.
Did you braid it?
No. I didn't braid it. I just went ruffian.
Okay.
Roughneck. So I was a townie, man. Townie.
I know.
You got to make it. You got to work with what you got. So what I was going to say is, I think historically people have thought of specialization as a necessary evil because... if you spread yourself too thin and do six different things, each of those requires like 4 years of internship, however many years of schooling, because the information wasn't freely available. All of these were closed silos, like photography was not too long ago, right?
Just a decade ago.
And you're able to become very well known very quickly by being open with your knowledge. And I think what's underestimated is how quickly you can actually delve into a subject, and if you have some modicum of intelligence and diligence, you can become, if you have any predisposition towards it, if you choose your sources good, you can become pretty damn good very quickly, right? So if you want to learn how to run a nonprofit, if it were 30 years ago, where are you going to go? How are you going to figure it out? Now, it's like, oh, you can watch, you can do a live Facebook Q&A with
Scott Harrison,
or the CEO of Donors Choose. Yeah, exactly. And so I think that... It's possible that the dilettante or jack of all trades is
rise up
in some ways. It's an outdated notion if people take advantage of the tools that are at their disposal. Yeah.
And you have been instrumental in unlocking that for a lot of people. I think that is one of my gifts or passions and gifts is to be able to learn quickly. Yeah. Wasn't necessarily a gift that I was born with, but just threw myself into something and not afraid to make some mistakes. I think those three things help. But like that, you're doing a great job. Nice job, man.
Thank you.
But like literally unlocking it. It is a sentiment that, again, I am continually sort of bombarded with people asking questions about how to, I end up being more of a career counselor, and I think you probably do too.
Happens a lot, yeah.
And it's following your passions, and you can't always, Steve Jobs said it, you can't connect the dots looking forward. Yeah. You can only connect them looking backwards. And now, again, knowing that my career as an artist and then developing the iPhone app, Best Camera, which allowed me to see scalable technology, get millions of users really quickly, and like, oh my God, it took me 5 years to build an audience of a million people, and then I did it in 5 weeks.
Yeah.
And then, you know, all of that feeds into Creative Live. And those are very disparate things. So,
how did you navigate the transition from, for lack of a better term, like solopreneur, right? Mm-hmm. You're a diehard talented creator who's hustled, made it happen, figured out a niche, making pretty good money, to building out a company and delegating, not getting into all the micro bits yourself. Because I think it seems to me that one of the biggest challenges that people face, and I face, quite frankly, in a lot of ways, is working on the business, not in the business. And obviously, you still have your time to do your creative work, which I think is very unique. Because a lot of people are like, you know, I used to be in the trenches. It was fun to code, but now I'm a management guy. That's just the way it goes. But you've managed to actually do both.
Yeah.
So how did you navigate that? What decisions did you make? What, like, epiphanies did you have? I mean, maybe you could just talk about that a bit.
Sure. That, I think intention plays a really big role in all of the scenarios you just sort of carved out in ad hoc. You're thinking, I did this and this and this.
I was just waving my hands and
it was good.
Fucking
you made some good noises.
Brain vomiting on you,
You made some good noises. You grunted a little bit. It was good. I inferred what you're saying. But intention, like, I feel like it's a, what kind of, like, it's a little bit of a fantasy life. What do you want to do? And it doesn't matter what you've heard. This is not possible. You can't be both of this and of this. Or you can't, you can't work 4 hours and get to travel the world and live like the new rich.
Yeah.
In Tim parlance, or Tim Ferriss parlance. My version of that was, I want to be able to make my living making things.
Yeah.
And then I realized that artists, as individuals, were not that scalable. Right? Dr. Dre made more from Beats selling his headphone company than he did from his music.
Yeah, sure.
In a year, just boom. Yeah. And so when I was thinking about an artist and making things, I always want to continue to make things, but you start to look at making and creating as not just the thing of pushing the shutter or saying action or directing the commercial or whatever, and making something that maybe is more scalable or following your passion. So being able to and that was, again, something I was told was not possible.
Yeah.
And so it's really looking to inspiration, to aspiring to the work that other people have done before you and thinking, oh my God, I thought it was not possible. Now I see this is possible. Go back to Bo Jackson playing football and baseball. No one had ever done that before. It's like, that's mind-blowing. And why not? These are the best athletes in the world. Of course, they're probably good at a lot of things.
Yeah.
And you talk about the birth or the rebirth of the polymath.
Yeah.
That was inspirational to me, and it helped me unlock a lot of that stuff. And I did so very intentionally. So what does a life look like where I get to do this and this and this? Mm-hmm. If you just sort of walk in the woods, you're likely to just bump into some trees. Yeah. If you sort of have a plan.
Well said.
Yeah. You're sort of sophisticated podcast you've got here, too.
Well, the best and brightest.
All right. And his third and final guest was Chase Jarvis. And then the podcast is Pulp. Go bigger. But a life that has some sort of intention.
Yeah.
And without being a militant planner, because that's not my. I think I have a nice balance of. I know where I want to go and set some goals, and I'm plenty of failure built in there.
Yeah.
But I think intention is a really overlooked thing. Like, you have to decide where you want to go if you want to get there.
So. Now, how did that affect what you said no to? Like, the before and after. So you decide, this is what I want.
Oh, wow.
What did you start saying no to? What did you start?
Things that didn't ladder up to the things that I wanted to do. Okay. And there's not always a direct, like, if I want to, if I want to be a rock climbing photographer, then I should say no to climbing trees.
Yeah, yeah.
Because there's still climbing involved, so that might help my climbing skills. That's a terrible analogy, but you get, like, there's a connection there, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's not always like, oh, I only take rock climbing gigs. Yeah. Or
Do you remember any gigs or clients that you said no to or fired that were?
Oh,
kind of milestones. I mean, not necessarily by name, but
sure.
Like,
I won't name them, but two things. Maybe three takeaways, and I'll see if I can remember them. Sometimes when I say three things, I can only remember two.
It's all right.
Like, later,
you can just sub it in later.
Okay, cool. So, one is saying no has a strong effect on the person who's trying to buy something from you, hire something. And I absolutely frown on being a dick.
Yeah.
There's no reason to be a dick.
Yeah.
Almost ever in the world, there's no reason to be a dick. So if I'm turning down work, it's like, thank you so much for thinking of me. It's just not in line with the work I'm doing right now, or the budgets aren't quite in line, or my schedule is like whatever. You know, make a relationship, be cordial. Mm-hmm. But there's this beautiful thing of if you are able to say no, usually for a budgetary reason.
Yeah.
When they get more money, if you've turned them down before, they remember that you were that prize that they couldn't get.
Yeah.
And when they do have more money, they are more likely to call you back if they liked your work.
Yeah.
So being able to say no, mean it.
Yeah.
It's a little bit of a luxury too. So this is not like day one of photography, start saying no to everybody. Yeah. Like you got to hustle. But once you sort of are able to be choosy and think on principle, is this going to move my goals forward?
Yeah.
Saying no will often make them come back. See, I already forgot thing two and thing three.
Wow, we didn't even get to two. Oh my God.
Let me try.
So any particular clients you've fired, maybe that
plenty of those. And again, trying to be cordial. And if the scope changes,
Dear John.
Yeah, there's a lot
your
of...
Your role in my life has been made redundant.
Is to steal Pareto's law.
Yeah.
You know, at the end of every year... and I think this can be said for a lot of customers or client relationships, that you make 80% of your money from 20% of your clients. So start looking at what did that 20% look like and how can you find more people or more customers or more X like that. And when someone is a pain in the ass, when they call and they're a pain in the ass or the last job they were a pain in the ass, you basically fire them not in the middle of that job because wouldn't want to harm your reputation. You do a kick-ass job, you finish all the way through, and then the next time they call, you are miraculously busy forever.
Indefinitely.
Indefinitely busy, and you can control that with the price. Like, oh, it's just my prices have got out of hand because there's a high demand. And like, well, what are they? And then you drop, and they're like, oh, God. Then sometimes they'll say, okay, well, we can... You know, and then if you put a price tag out there that was totally absurd, then you might be willing to take a couple of gut punches to make that. But so understanding where your bread is buttered and what clients are ones that you enjoy working for. Again, keeping in mind that all of these things should ladder up to the big goals that we were talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. What do you want to be, do? Where do you want to go? Or do you want to just walk in the woods? That's two or three.
I don't want to walk in the woods because, as you said, I just walk into trees.
Bump into trees.
So what are some of your goals currently?
I have huge aspirations.
Personal or otherwise?
I'll go straight to Creative Live. I have huge aspirations to Creative Live. And we've already educated millions of people in every country around the world. And the hope is that by creating free education, that we can make the world a more creative and better place. Yeah. Just so happens that there's a great business model behind it, which is a freemium one that anyone in the world can watch for free while the content is being created live, and if you want to own a copy.
I'm smirking just because I have to cut in, because
please,
I remember I was so curious at one point, and obviously I've sort of been along for the ride for a while, and there are a lot
launched
of...
Launched the 4-Hour Chef on Creative Live.
Did indeed. And you know, I think the quality, just the background that you have in production... and the people you've hired bring a level of professionalism to the production that is broadcast quality with multiple cameras. I mean, you've got dollies, you've got stuff on lines. I mean, it's
you were going to record this with an iPhone.
There's always I was going to record this with an 8-track, and then I'm glad you vetoed me. But I think that there's always a market for quality.
Yeah.
Like I was just talking to some entrepreneurs today. I'm digressing for a second. I was talking to some entrepreneurs today, and they're like, "All right, we're going to compete on price against Company X." And I'm like, "If Company X." has a lot of money or simply doesn't know how to do math properly and they want to bleed you, they can compete on price and they can hurt you for a long time. But there's always a market for highest quality.
Yeah. Huge kudos to the team that produces this podcast for one, but all of the work.
This
there's
episode,
been a ton of
this podcast.
Yes. Unless I'm going to get a call from you afterwards, like, you know, boy, that studio just worked out really good. I got another one next week. We want someone who's nice and smart and dashing though, so you won't be asked back. That being said, there's a passion for quality here for sure, and a passion for education. So that I have big goals there.
What I was smirking about, if I could just tell
please
a funny story.
Please keep smirking, telling a story.
No, because I remember when we were first when you were telling me about Creative Live, and then I heard you telling somebody else, and generally you'd be like, it doesn't matter if you're a techie in San Francisco or if you're that 12-year-old boy in Malaysia. And I heard that a couple times. I'm like, I want to meet this 12-year-old in Malaysia. He is a go-getter. That man is on it. I've said a couple times in a row recently,
whether you're in Nebraska or Nairobi, and I don't know where that came from.
The alliteration. Yeah,
how about it?
But it's true, right? And I think, well, just explain the model briefly, because I mean, a lot of people have an exposure to it.
Sure. We bring world-class people in photography, filmmaking, design, any sort of the arts, audio, engineering, music, the maker movement, crafting.
Business, too. I mean, yeah,
entrepreneurship.
Startup week.
Sure, Guy Kawasaki, Reid Hoffman, yourself. There's you know, Lewis Howes, Ramit Sethi. There's all kinds of really great courses. And we bring those people on and film, like you said, in super high quality HD, usually between 4 and 8 cameras, and broadcast live while we're making this workshop. So instead of a TED Talk that's like 15 or 18 minutes, this is 1, 2, or 3 days with that same quality person. So you go really deep on something. Yeah. And if you tune in while it's live, it's completely free.
Yeah.
Anyone can watch it. And if you do decide that you want to own the thing and watch it over and over obsessively, like people do with your Tim Ferriss show, then you have to buy it.
Yep.
And so for the people that don't have the ability to, don't have money, they can get all of the same benefits. If you do have money and you prefer convenience, you just press buy.
Yeah.
And so it's a beautiful business model that cultivates creativity, access, community, some of our sort of key values. So it's working too.
It is working.
It's working.
What is, so on the personal side.
Yep.
What are some of your goals, priorities, resolutions?
Charlie's book. Let's get back to that.
Oh, yeah.
Play.
Sure.
Play. Okay. Play. Is it called Play It Away?
Play Your Anxiety.
Play Your Anxiety Away or something.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily suffer from anxiety.
Play It Away.
Play It Away. Of the classic, like, I'm going to, like, seize up when I get on camera, but I keep a lot of balls in the air. I've got a brain that's whizzing at 3 in the morning, and the idea of taking care of yourself and finding a way to play.
Yeah.
Charlie's example is the home run derby.
This is Charlie Hone.
Charlie Hone,
H-O-E-H-N.
Oh, thank my. You. Is this a refill?
Wow.
Do you get this on the random show?
You know, I'm going to have to switch to
switch to that?
Ginger and Jack. Looks pretty good.
Good one. How about it, huh? So that's a big Ginger and Jack with no rocks. But the idea of introducing play, because we work very, very hard at Creative Live and as a creative professional, long hours, you know, a lot of stuff, a lot of balls in the air. And, you know, we've got investors, there's like your ass is on the line, so to speak. And just taking 30 minutes or an hour to try and find some way to play, to be active in a day, is just incredibly helpful for me. So kudos to Charlie, wherever you are out there.
What have you been doing? So what have you built in?
Horseshoes. There's a horseshoe park by my house in the Green Lake area of Seattle. Randomly, and it's lit, so you can like have a really intense work session, and then after work or at midnight, you can go throw
like
horseshoes.
You go like do the meth heads come and congregate, and they try to catch the horseshoes, or what happened?
No, horseshoe, but it's a totally random thing. Like, I'm not like a big horseshoe guy.
See, I was thinking that guy looks like he throws a mean horseshoe.
I'm seeing, you know, Kelly Starrett, good friend of ours, I'll say. He recommended Dave Werner, who is basically an athletic trainer, former Navy SEAL in Seattle, and I've got terrible shoulders.
Yeah.
I had a couple of blowouts from football and soccer, and so I've had reconstructive surgery, and they've never really quite been the same.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, Kelly from his knowledge base and Dave Werner up in Seattle, they have amazing approach to sort of physical therapy. And they're badasses. They're like mobility experts. And so I'm working from the ground up on rebuilding the small muscles in my shoulder instead of just doing the big stuff. And so that I can surf again, because surfing was a big passion of mine for a long time. And I can't really paddle out.
Yeah.
You got me the swimming, you know, the swimming video you sent to me.
On the total immersion.
Yeah, total immersion. Yeah. But my shoulders have been so bad. So I'm being really physically active, going to see those guys, Dave, at least twice a week, sometimes three times a week, so that I can enable some of these passions of mine, like surfing.
Cool. You should get some Sissus quadrangularis for your shoulders.
Yes?
Yes. We can talk about that.
Please.
Really helpful for knees and shoulders.
Isn't that guy who rolled the boulder up the hill?
That's Sisyphus.
I'm just kidding. bum, bum.
That would
it's
be great.
All laughs all the time here on the Tim Ferriss podcast.
I could have my line of supplements that are all named after like Greek tragedies. That'd be wow. If people didn't think I was pompous already, that would really do it.
That's that Princeton in you, my friend.
I know, comes
you
out.
Take the kid out of Princeton, but you wait.
Can't take the mullet off the
Princeton
Long Islander.
Kid.
I don't know. Sorry, mixing up my metaphors. Cool, man. You know, I mean, at this point, obviously, you've done a lot. We've done a lot, too.
We have done a lot today.
I won't keep you too much longer.
Dude,
but
I'm happy. Speaking of happy. What's that?
I wanted to ask you.
Speaking of happy.
What do you feel have become your top priorities in feeling happy or fulfilled? Like, what are the things, as you become wiser, that you've learned to prize more or prize less?
Health.
Yeah.
Having a Jim Morrison type career where you explode at 28 in a fiery ball is not cool.
Yeah.
Kurt Cobains, you know, the artists that have, well, we all know that Magic, is it 28 or 29, whatever that evil year is, it's taken so many amazing artists from us, but that's not cool. Health and longevity and being able to enjoy it is like fundamental. And until it's taken away, you don't actually, until you have a couple of surgeries, you break yourself a little bit. And that's not to say I'm encouraging people to push themselves athletically, whatever. I'm not saying don't get hurt, but one's health and being active is incredibly valuable.
Yeah.
And these are, I feel like an old person saying this next one, which is sleep. I have lived on 4 to 6 hours sleep for the last 10 years.
Yeah.
And I go really hard, and then I will like nosedive for 18 hours.
This is why you can only remember one thing on your list of three.
I know. There you go. And I've found a sort of a new passion for sleep. I can't ever, not never, but I rarely get the 8, 9, 10.
Yeah.
But if I get 7, 8, it's a complete, I have a completely different experience.
So what have you shifted? I mean, has it been simply a matter of scheduling? Like, how are you making
It's an intention.
Decisions?
Like, should I go out and have one more cocktail with my buddies?
Yeah.
Or I'm going to be more fresh if I go to sleep.
Eat some Yoplait, watch Golden Girls, and call it a night.
That's right. Boom. High five. I'm out. No, but so just prioritizing sleep.
Yeah.
And
definitely.
The third one is meditation.
Mm.
Meditation.
Oh, yes. We haven't talked about this in a while.
Uh-huh. You were on it for a good bit. Then you said you fell off the wagon.
I fell off the wagon. But yeah, you're one of two people that I credit with finally kind of kicking me in the ass to take it seriously.
It has really been
specifically TM, so Transcendental Meditation, for those who don't know, or trademark.
Yeah.
it's, you know, I have my issues with almost every form of meditation. There are pros and cons. We talked about them before, but tell me about your meditation practice.
And my meditation practice is not perfect, and none are.
Yeah.
I just sit down between 15 and 20 minutes twice a day. Sometimes I only get one time a day.
Yeah.
Sometimes those are a little compressed, or they don't, you know, shit happens, or you're on an airplane, and the captain comes on and pulls you out of it, or whatever.
Like,
but I make a conscious effort to just observe my thoughts and practice TM in the morning and the evening before dinner. And it has made, it's sort of the analogy that I can, you know, most simply put here on your show is, it's when you're in the zone, say playing sports or playing music, and things just seem effortless.
Yeah.
It's called a flow state. Stephen Kotler's new book, which is a good book, The Rise of Superman, check that out.
Yeah.
A little plug for his book about creativity and flow states. But that sense of flow, it's when things sort of happen in slow motion. Now, you're not literally talking in slow motion, but you have the same clarity as if you're going through life and everything's happening in slow motion. Instead of that, I'm hyper-caffeinated, my boss is,
I'm agitated, you know,
yeah,
I'm reactive, dodging bullets.
Yeah, he's instead, you're just like, I'm driving the bus here, and we're going to go here, and then I'm going to do this. And there's just certain clarity that and it's like magic. It's really weird. And there's another thing, I don't know if you felt this, Tim, but it sort of aggregates. So you get good benefit from 1, 2, 3, 4, and then when you're on a roll, there's this sort of exponential, there's a little overdrive that it's like, oh my gosh, I feel like I'm just floating.
Yeah, I can't explain it either, but for me, and just for those people who might be thinking like I did for my entire life, like,
bullshit. Yeah,
bullshit. No, just like, I don't want people ohming me and freaking, you know, all this, shock or whatever, like I'm not into it.
Yeah.
Especially living in San Francisco, I've developed sort of an allergy to like sanctimonious, and I've been to Burning Man, but like sanctimonious burner types who like want to lecture me about chakras. I'm just like, honestly, please, I can't handle another minute of this. So I've had this aversion to meditation, but when it's very sort of non-dogmatic, where it's just like, look, you're not trying to control anything, you're not trying to think of a candle flame, like just observe your thoughts and be okay with them, and sit with good posture for this period of time. That's it. And even if you think it's a shitty job and you're like running through your to-do list or thinking of the stock market, that's okay. Just make it part of your routine. Yeah. And what I found was, and some people who, well-known people who do TM, I mean, it's like Paul McCartney, Arianna Huffington.
David Lynch.
David Lynch. I'm blanking on his name for some reason, but Bridgewater Capital, largest hedge fund in, if not the world, the United States.
Russell Simmons.
100 billion plus. Ray Dalio, that's it. Russell Simmons. So
the list is I think, like Howard Stern. I mean, it's
yeah, the
like,
list
it's
is pretty
crazy.
Amazing. Yeah, it's, Seinfeld.
Yeah.
And the physiological or psychological effects are so fascinating, like you said, because you'll do it for a couple days and you're like, man, like, yeah, okay, whatever. And then you hit this, like, you hit this sort of inflection point where suddenly you just drop from like 200 RPMs to 150 and you're like, whoa, okay, this is different. And then the whole week you're kind of zenned out.
Yep.
And then after, say, a 4 week period, and I did my first retreat a few months ago, before I volunteered for the masochism that is television production.
I can just hit you with a stick for a couple weeks.
If you could just like, if you could put a nail through it first, that'd be great. Really had this tremendous effect on me that oddly enough, and maybe this is getting too out there for some people, but very similar to my experiences post relatively high dose hallucinogens.
Yeah.
This like extended period of calm,
grace,
and ease, ease in decision making.
Yep.
Like uncluttered, like you closed every browser on your computer and turned off the antivirus and rebooted the whole thing.
Yeah.
That type of feeling.
Yep.
So I did fall off the train. Question for you, because I find the morning session I usually find pretty easy.
Yep. Afternoon is hard.
Afternoon.
I'm right now thinking of, okay, I got to go from here to the thing to the thing, and when am I going to get my thing in? Like, oh, shit.
Yeah. Sometimes I'll try to do it in a car.
Yeah.
Like Uber or whatever. Mm-hmm. When do you typically do it in the afternoon? Curious.
I try and do it before dinner sometime.
Okay.
Between work and dinner.
Yeah.
We're entrepreneurs. We work.
It's tough.
Crazy long hours. So I'll take it whenever I can get it. And it's usually a little bit less gracious than my morning one. Like you said, it's sort of like morning is like, it's your time. You carve about 20 minutes. So my afternoon one is often a little bit more piecemeal. But again, it's the act. I try not to judge the practice. The practice is the practice.
Yeah. So, are you, when you meditate, are you sitting cross-legged? Are you sitting with your feet?
I try and sit in a comfortable chair, flat on the floor, hands on my lap.
Yeah.
Okay. And there's a mantra that if you learn sort of TM, you're given a mantra and say that word over and over. And if some thoughts come in, they're like, oh, there's those thoughts. Bye. And they go away and you just keep doing it over again. And then sometimes like, oh my God, that was 25 minutes.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's like, oh my God, that was 1 minute. It felt like a week. Like a week. And again, but just not judging that. And it's without, continuing to talk about it, because now it's getting weird because we're talking about it so much.
Yeah.
But it's just a powerful tool that is so simple.
I'm just mind melding while you're talking.
It's
right
great.
Now.
You're meditating. You're staring off. At
I haven't
space.
Been listening to you
for the
20,
listening people.
20
out
minutes.
There,
I've not been.
Tim
listening
is
to you.
Staring into space right now. He's not paying attention to us.
Okay, so let's. That is, I think, a huge takeaway for people. It doesn't have to be TM. It could be Vipassana. It could be just anything.
Sure.
Building in a pause, which is like a warm bath for your brain, even if it's 10 minutes a day. So that you're not in a reactive mode. It's really a game changer. And physiologically, it had a lot of effects for me as well.
Oh, yeah.
So like when my cortisol level dropped, I was able to lose body fat more easily in my abdomen, for instance. Really, I became very sensitive to alcohol and caffeine. So I dropped it, but they dropped them both significantly. Not because I was getting judgmental about it because I was oversensitized to it. Yeah. I'd grown immune to the effect, so I could have like 6 cups of coffee a day and be like, eh. And then met TM for 4 or 5 weeks, and it was like I had 1 cup, and I'm like, wow.
Wow.
I didn't realize what my baseline was.
Yep.
So just maybe to
make you a cheap date too, by the way.
I've always been a cheap date. For those people who might be wondering, well, Chase, you know, you started back in this period when YouTube wasn't even YouTube, and you had this opportunity to be the first to be transparent, and I could never do that because now it's too crowded, and now the world is different. If you were starting now, starting over, knowing what you know now, as a photographer, we'll just use that as an example.
Sure.
How would you think about going about it? I mean, what would your process look like?
I would go straight to, I think, when, again, assuming you get good at your craft, and you get good at your craft through imitation and practice and hacking the system, taking it from 10,000 hours down to 4, or whatever the system is, but let's just take it for granted that you're good at your craft. In the process of developing skills at the craft, I feel like the answers are actually in here.
Yeah.
And as what it is that we're all trying to do as entrepreneurs and or artists, I think... Not all of us. I don't want to speak for everyone. But I think there's one of the differentiating characteristics, the zig instead of the zag, the how do you stand out in a loud, noisy world, is the answers are in here. And trying to take pictures that no one else in the world can take and trying to make things that no one else in the world can make. Because you're the product of this, of a unique sort of life and trajectory.
Yeah.
I've said earlier in the podcast that everything is sort of a remix, but what is your version of the remix? And so, say, I have a relationship with a bunch of celebrities, so I might be able to get a photograph of them in a way that no one else could because they were on my couch playing PlayStation or something in a way that you're not going to see that person. Yeah. So that's a terrible example. We've got a lot of terrible examples in this year, but the point is like thinking about like what's the unique mojo that I bring, and how can I try and amplify that? Amplify your strengths rather than sort of fix your weaknesses. Outsource.
Yeah.
Outsource
or you could take. I mean, just something came to mind is take. If you're not perhaps the best person at capturing something visually, but you're a good storyteller, you have your visual art, and then you have an incredible narrative to go with it.
Absolutely.
And when I go into art galleries, and this is not my particular, I don't have the budget for it, but it's also, I'm more of a classical type guy, but if you walk into, say, the Gagosian galleries in New York, and you'll see stuff on the wall, $10 million, you can't figure out what it is, but you read the plaque next to it, and you're like, that's a damn good story.
Yeah,
like, it's beautiful. I see how they are selling these things.
The narrative plays in, and also that... Well, that there is a narrative and that it's a compelling one. I think both those things are true for anything that you're sort of positioning or selling or creating. I want to know the backstory. I feel that's sort of it's an underappreciated art to be able to tell a good story. To be like, and that's another weird background thing on me is I was in a PhD program in philosophy of art. So I learned how to talk really critically about art. And then you think of the learned skill of being able to talk about why I shot it like this, and people that is a part of their experience when they have hired me as an artist in the past. So there's a value add there that being able to tell a story and talk about what it is that you're making is valuable. So rewind a little bit to go back, what would you do? I would focus on doing things that I know that I'm passionate about, that I can do differently or better or more uniquely based on what's in here, not necessarily what's out there.
Yeah.
Got to learn from out here and imitate and hack and steal and all those things that we do. But then as soon as you can, start applying it to very personal sort of vulnerability. Brené Brown is going to be on my show on April 9th. Daring Greatly. We're dropping a lot of good books now. And I remembered Mark Echo's book is How to Sell You Without Selling Out. Mm-hmm. Sell Yourself Without Selling Out. These are other good titles. But sort of vulnerability. What is a place that you can come from that when you're vulnerable, you're actually showing strength?
Yeah, I remember, I think it was Neil Gaiman, one of my favorite writers, or maybe someone else, but it's like when you're writing and you start to feel really uncomfortable, that's when you know you're starting to get it right.
Yep.
And I'd imagine that applies to photography, applies to everything.
And I feel it I feel it with Creative Live. The stakes start getting high, and you're like, wow, this is going to be a big deal. That means you're sort of, now you're like poking some hot spots. So.
Awesome.
I think that's an important takeaway. I know there are probably others.
That's solid, man. No, I'd say we'll have everything in the show notes for people to check out. Obviously, creativelive.com. And maybe we can just close on one of my favorite quotes. It's actually also a commencement speech that everybody should check out by Neil Gaiman.
Neil, I was going to reference it earlier.
Make good art.
Make good art.
Cat exploded, make good art. Got divorced, wife ran away with the pool boy, make good art. Make good art. That is the bedrock.
That is. And you don't want to end the podcast quite yet because you said you were going to come back to a horrifying story that I had experienced.
Oh my God, you're totally right. I'm glad you saved me from that embarrassing call out.
You asked me to save you in your text to me. I said, what do I need to do for prep? You said, nothing. Just save me if I need saving.
I said, be your charming and unshaven self. And and secondly, if I fuck up the conversation, you need to save it. So thank you.
No problem.
Well done.
Professional saver.
Catastrophic self-inflicted injury. Yeah, let's hear it. Doesn't have to be catastrophic. Self-inflicted injuries.
So I'm sort of young. I don't remember quite the exact age. I'm at a wedding.
Yeah, okay.
What is it called? I'm an only child, so I'm just kind of cruising, you know, looking for some other, maybe let's say I'm 10, looking for some other 10-year-old girl to dance with or something, just cruising the wedding in my little tuxedo. And there's this commotion over the dance floor. I'm probably like measuring the cake or something. There's a commotion on the dance floor. I'm like, what's going on over there? And I see there's this group of brides. Yeah. And then there's a group of women.
Yeah, or women, yeah.
And then there's the bride at the front, and she has this flowers, and she's doing this thing. She's like, God, she's going like, what? Dude, it's a gigantic wedding. And I'm in the wings. See if you can follow me in here. And I'm like, oh, she's going to throw that flower. And then I'm just, I come just banking around the corner on full speed sprint. Sure enough, she throws the flowers end over end. Just see this in slow motion, just da 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 da. Full laid out swan dive. Grab the flowers in front of 50 outstretched arms, pull it in, come sliding to a stop on the dance floor, hand in the air with the bouquet. Gah! Fucking silence. 250 people, like. And she had to do it again.
Oh, nice.
It was
retake. That is amazing.
It was so terrible.
I think that's like the essence of chase right there.
Oh, that's right. Record scratch. Oh. But there's so many. I got lots of embarrassing moments.
I love that.
I like being 10. Maybe I was 8. I don't know if that's too old to know. Like I should have known what was going on, or I have no idea what age I was. But
no, you were just overflowing with amazing Pele-like soccer ability. Didn't know what to do with that at a wedding, I think.
There you go.
We'll have a round two, man. We'll have more stories.
Thank you.
And thank you for coming on the show.
Yeah, pleasure.
Until next time.
I will pimp it. I'll share it far and wide as much as I can. Ciao. Bye, everybody.
Ciao.
Thanks for staying late. Arigato gozaimasu.
Arigato gozaimasu.
If you want more of The Tim Ferriss Show, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or go to 4hourblog.com.
FourHourBlog.com.
Where you'll find an award-winning blog, tons of audio and video interview stories with people like Warren Buffett and Mike Shinoda from Linkin Park, the books, plus much, much more. Follow Tim on Twitter. It's twitter.com/tferriss. That's
T-F-E-R-R-I-S-S.
Or on Facebook at facebook.com/timferriss. Until next time, thanks for listening.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. do more with Viator.